is Martha Nix Wade with An Exposed Secret. You know, I'm really happy this evening because my daughter decided to come with me today. You're not going to hear her voice because she just wants to sit there on Snapchat and make silly faces with her friends. And she's giving me that look, you know, that every teenage girl gives her mom. But we're glad that you're tuning in and that you care about protecting children and encouraging those who have experienced sexual abuse to start their process of healing and to be fully committed, because they're that important, to pour in the time into their life and understand that they're a treasure, and that in that we need to take time to heal and understand how to go about that. And so I've invited a special guest this evening, and her name is Carol Erton. And Carol has written a book, When Hope Hurts. And I just want you to welcome her and listen to her story and how she's worked through that. And even though there were times where it hurt, that she has found hope. Carol, welcome to An Exposed Secret.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Carol, can you talk to us about your childhood and what, you know, that was like growing up?
Well, I had a very difficult childhood. I was actually born into a very religious family. Both my parents were Christians, and they married and had my brother and I. My brother was 3 years older than I was. But about 8 years into the marriage, when I was two and my brother was five, my father decided to leave my mom and just abandoned all of us. So we really didn't have anywhere to go except for home to my grandparents' house. So we went to my mom's house, and or her original house, and moved in with my grandparents. And, you know, that time of my life was really, it was fun. I don't remember anything about being with my dad, but I do remember living with my grandparents for a limited amount of time. And it was just a very loving home. It was just a wonderful place. My grandparents absolutely adored my brother and I, and they were really happy to be able to help my mom. But shortly after that, through church, my mom met a man that was actually a leader in the church. He was a deacon in the church. He was quite a bit older than my mom. He was 25 years older than she was. And they wound up getting married. And unfortunately, this man was a pedophile, and he married my mom just for the sole purpose of abusing my brother and I. And so we went from, you know, just a lot of change in a very short period of time in my young life. I was 5 years old when they got married, and it was very confusing because we were going to church, yet we were at home. We were being abused by this man who claimed to be a Christian. And shortly after we all moved in together, he actually moved us into just a broken down old shack in the Northeast LA area to isolate us from anybody who would want to come visit. My mom didn't want to have anyone come visit us, and she was embarrassed of our house. And then they actually moved my brother back with my grandparents. My mom was set up with an account to travel, and so she was traveling the world and leaving me home alone with this man in this broken-down shack for just, you know, days and weeks at a time.
And that started at the age of five?
The age of five, yes.
Do you remember your feelings in those early times? Was there a grooming process, or did he immediately move in and start violating you sexually?
Yeah, there was definitely a grooming process. You know, I talk about in the book, you know, there was one instance before they actually married that there was a situation where a fire truck was going by, and I climbed up on some cabinets to watch this fire truck go by. I was excited. I was a little kid. And when I jumped down, I landed right on the cabinet, the open door of the cabinet, and you know, I just straddled it, and I hit it hard, and I was crying and holding myself. And at that time, he was over visiting us. This was before they were actually married, and he suggested that my mom let him check out the damage to see if I was hurt. And she allowed him to do that. And that, I believe, at that moment, he knew that he was going to have access to me anytime he wanted to.
Right, because he was obviously studying the way in which your mom interacted with you and then what she allowed.
Yes, absolutely.
And have you had the opportunity to talk to your mom about those early days?
Oh, yeah. We've talked about this for years. It's been, you know, a lot of the book, when I talk about families, it's just really difficult when kids are abused, and then, you know, we grow up, and you go through just a myriad of different things, but so many people have difficulty dealing with the family situation for years and years and years. And when my children were little, it became a big deal because I had come to a point where I was starting to recover. I'd been to some counseling, and I realized that there was just absolutely no way that my children could be allowed to be anywhere near him. And so I broke off all communication with the family. I still communicated with my mom and my brother, but I didn't allow any visitation with the stepfather. We didn't do Christmas together. We didn't do Thanksgiving together. And what happens to adult survivors when they get to a point and they're not fully recovered and they start making boundaries for themselves, the family objects and you become the bad guy. And it's very, very difficult. It's very hard to maintain that because the blame is always shifted back to you. I was told many times that the family was having problems because of me, because I couldn't let things go.
I hear that time and time again. Obviously, you know you're not alone, but some of our listeners are probably thinking right now, oh my goodness, that happened to you too?
Yes.
Because we don't understand that, you know, a lot of people do buy into lies, and they're so worried about family image that they keep silent.
Yes, well, the family image is everything. You know, when this secret finally came out, he actually abused me for 9 years. He was sexually abusing me and using me for child pornography. And it was, again, just the most confusing time of my life as a child because we were in church every Sunday and every Wednesday. And, you know, every day for 9 years as a little girl, I just prayed, you know, Lord, please, please don't let this happen anymore. Make it stop. And finally, at the age of 14, there were a lot of reasons, but I, you know, I was in danger and I needed to get away. I needed to be out of the situation, and I just didn't know what to do. So I actually ran away from home, and I didn't want my mom to be worried about me, so I called her and told her where I was, but that I wouldn't be coming home. And so when this came out, we all had a big family discussion, and I was silenced. I was told to never tell anybody what had happened in our home, what had happened to me. And they packed up my things and shipped me down to live with my grandparents.
And where was your brother at this time?
My brother was 3 years older than I was. So about the time I was entering high school, he was graduating. And my brother had been just horribly emotionally and physically abused by this man. And so we were just two completely opposite people. My brother was a very big, dark-haired, blue-eyed guy and very quiet, introverted. And I was a very small, blonde-haired, brown-eyed little girl. And I was a little more vocal about things, not in the early years, but as I became a teenager, I was not quiet. I was angry about what had happened, and so we were just two completely different people. But when this came out, my brother was graduating, and I was going into high school, and he just couldn't function on his own. He had never recovered from what was done to him. He was very quiet, not able to really talk. He was very smart, very good in school. And so we just literally switched places. He went back home to live in that shack in L.A., and I was shipped down to, my grandparents had moved to San Diego County, a little town called Julian down there. And so my brother came home to L.A., and I went to Julian to live with my grandparents.
Did his mental and physical health get worse in that move, or did he maintain the same characteristics?
He was always very quiet, very sullen. He was, you know, the only thing that really kept my brother alive was his faith in God. And both my brother and I came to know the Lord at a very young age. And my brother loved God. He continued to go to church. He continued to put up with now just the verbal abuse of my stepfather. But he did love God. But unfortunately, because he never was able to get help, he never talked about it. In later years, as I was recovering, I really encouraged him to get counseling, and he just couldn't do it, and he was just really stuck in this abusive atmosphere. And he remembered our father. Our father, when our father left, he actually told my brother he would come back and get him, and he never did. We never heard from him again, and so my brother kind of always lived with this you know, just big hole in his heart that our father left, and then, of course, you know, being abused by the stepfather. And so ultimately, he developed colon cancer, and he passed away at a very young age. He got colon cancer when he was 39, passed away at 44. But I do have to say that, you know, in his lifetime, he was able to reach out and do some things. He went on a lot of trips with his church and went to other countries and, you know, really shared his love for God with a lot of people. And it was just an amazing thing that he was able to do that despite everything.
So through that experience, do you believe that untreated trauma can fester itself in a cancer?
Oh, absolutely. I do.
And have you seen people begin that healing process and experience physical transformation where they've started to heal physically as they heal their selves mentally?
Well, yeah, you know, as we hold all this in, it can, you know, and it not every untreated victim is going to develop into cancer, but a lot of people experience headaches and stomach problems, all sorts of different physical ailments that really plague them, and it can turn into a lot of different types of physical things. And we do find that, you know, when we begin to recover just emotionally, mentally, and physically, life just becomes completely different. I talk a lot about that in the book, about, you know, the need to get counseling, the need to work through it. And it's difficult. I remember going through counseling and literally thinking that I could possibly lose my mind. I was afraid. It was scary. It was hard to go through it all. You know, there was just so much in that 9 years that I had experienced that I didn't want to talk about. I didn't want to remember. I didn't want to go through it all again. But as I did, and I began to heal mentally and to work all that through, and then to realize later that, you know, I didn't have any illness symptoms like my brother, but I did a lot of drinking and self-destructive behaviors that weren't good for me. And so a huge part of my healing has been to be healthy, to eat well, to exercise, to not put anything in my body that is altering in any way, mind-altering in any way, you know, drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, anything like that, and to just really stay physically fit, because it's really important for our mental state to be, just to be balanced, to have that balance between mental, physical, and then the spiritual connection. If I didn't have God in my life, absolutely I would not be here today.
I want to step back, and we're going to come back to this about that full healing of mind, physical nature, and spiritual. But I want to go back when you talked about coming out with your family about what was happening in that shack. And who were the people that believed you and helped you in that to start bringing you hope?
Well, it, you know, unfortunately, in the beginning, there was just no one. I had actually gone to a youth leader in our church, and, you know, at this time, there really weren't mandated reporting laws. People didn't understand abuse. And I was able to tell a leader in our church, one of the youth workers, that some inappropriate stuff was going on. Now, mind you, I'm a 14-year-old girl, so this is it was very difficult for me to verbalize what was going on. But I told this person enough that, you know, they knew that there was something wrong. And at that time, the decision was being made that I may go live with my grandparents. And I told him I was going to run away from home. And he said, you need to run to your grandparents' house. You just need to get to your grandparents' house. And unfortunately, he kept that information to himself. And so when the story came out with my stepfather and my mother, he threatened us, told us never to tell anyone. And so as a 14-year-old girl, I entered high school in this new little town, somewhere that was far away from my home, and no one helped me. It was years. It took years for this to come out. I struggled through high school. I barely graduated. My grades were horrible. I was drinking. I was just the party kid. And, you know, on one hand, I was very successful. I was popular. I was a cheerleader. It was kind of always a dual thing for me. When I got to be an adult, I always did very well in business. I worked for a lot of great companies, held some really great positions. I got married. I had children. I began living this life of perfectionism. You know, I was achieving, trying to achieve, trying to be perfect. And on the other hand, I was really drowning my sorrows in alcohol and just all these different behaviors that came out. Like I said, the perfectionism, the controlling everything, trying to control everything in my life. And so it wasn't until I was 27 years old that I ever told anyone the extent of what had happened to me.
And who was that person that you told?
Well, I was going to a church in California here, and it was an interesting situation. I had been married, and through all everything that was going on, we wound up getting divorced about 5 years later. We had had our son, and my life just was falling apart. It was completely falling apart. And I knew that if I didn't get a grip on life, if I didn't just really give my life back over to God and let Him try to handle it, that I just wasn't going to survive. And so I started going to church again. And through that process, my ex-husband and I wound up seeing each other again and decided that we were going to try to work things out. And I really felt this desire to go back and try to right every wrong I'd ever done. And so he moved in with me at a condo I had bought, and we were living together. And then I began to worry that, you know, I was not doing the right thing by living with my ex-husband. And so I made an appointment with this pastor at the church to talk about the situation, because I really, rather than healing through God's love, I began trying to earn His love by doing everything the right way. And so I sat down with this pastor and started telling him the story about my ex-husband and I and this crazy mess that we were in and how we wound up there. And he said, you know, I don't want to talk about that right now. He said, let's set that aside for a minute. He said, do me a favor. And I said, what? And he said, tell me about your father. And I looked at him and I said, I don't want to talk about my father. I want to talk about the situation. I just want you to tell me what to do, and I'm going to go do what I need to do. And he said, he said, tell me about your father. And so I said, well, my father left when I was 2, and then I had a stepfather, and we didn't get along, and wanted to just go back to my other problem. And he said, well, why didn't you get along? And he just gently prodded me until I began to tell the story. And for the first time there, I was able to not talk about everything. It was years before we could talk about the child pornography, but I was able to tell him what I had been through. And we never did wind up talking about my marriage situation. He immediately set me up with a Christian counselor to begin going through the process of trying to heal from my childhood, because that was the true problem.
Did he share at any point what gave him that perspective to go back and get to the seed of the issues and find out where that core had planted itself a long time ago? Where that pastor, what did he see in you that knew to go back and ask about the relationship with your father?
Well, so many women struggle in their marriages because, and just with life in general, because of the relationship they've had with their father. And I think I had told him enough about the situation and, you know, how I'd wound up with this man and just the history of it, that he could see that there was something way beyond a marital problem, that my problem was much bigger than that. And I don't know. I don't know if it was, you know, the prompting of the Holy Spirit in his life to know that that's what it was. I really never talked to him after that first session. I began going to the counselor, and through that began my healing process. So I just know that God was in that situation, and it just all came out for the first time then.
And it's so important for us to know that a lot of times when we've experienced childhood trauma and we haven't had the opportunity to work through it, it will play out in other relationships. And we can deal with those relationships all we want, but until we get to the core of where we lost trust, or where we lost our own personal identity and who we were created to be, we'll always be scrambling in relationships. It's so important to look back on that little girl or that little boy and fall in love with that child and start to love that child as we were meant to be loved, and understand if we weren't loved in an appropriate, unconditional way. And we encourage all of the people that we work with to fall in love with that child and start to father that child or mother like that child in order, in the way in which they were created to be loved and cherished. And so I'm just amazed that he saw that and had you go back and start to work on that. What were the difficulties you experienced as you were working through that healing with that counselor?
Well, a lot of different things. I mean, the depression, there was a lot of depression. There was, you know, of course, having to work through it, to talk about it, to come to a lot of conclusions that I didn't want to come to. And one of those was that my mother probably knew what was going on. And that was one of the most difficult things to face. So going through that, and just like I said earlier, really wondering if I was going to lose my mind. There were times when I was so distraught that I just didn't think that I would survive. It was just a huge, huge painful thing, and it was hard to work through. But I knew that I had to do it. I knew that my life was not going to get better unless I just worked through. And so what I did, I really took the advice of my counselor. When he told me to read a certain book, I would do that. When he told me to do a certain exercise, I would do that. There was work on my end that had to be done in order to get through this process. And while it was difficult, it was definitely worth it. And I was able to not only go back and to begin to love that child, but to understand that God loved that child. When I left that home at 14 years old, I truly thought God had abandoned me completely, and I could not understand where he was. And I really, truly felt, I knew he was there. I still believed in him. I just didn't think he loved me.
And how did you transform that thought that he didn't love you and he had abandoned you?
Well, it took time. It took time. And at that point in time, when I did start going through counseling, I did have some really great family members that, on my father's side of the family, while he had abandoned us, his family stayed in touch with us. So I had some wonderful aunts and uncles on that side. And I'll just never forget my uncle showing me a verse in the Bible when this had all come out. And we were working on a plan, once I'd been through quite a bit of counseling, on how I would begin to help others. And so he began sharing with me just some really great things in the Bible that talk about these very situations. And one of them was a verse in the Psalms that says, "Though my father and mother have forsaken me, the Lord will take me up." And when I heard that verse, I couldn't believe it. I felt like it had been written just for me. And, you know, in 2 Samuel, there's a situation where a young girl is raped by one of her brothers. And it's really interesting because the family comes to her and says, you know, "Now you need to don't take this to heart. You need to remain silent." And it says that she did remain silent, and she lived desolate in her father's house forever. So there are a lot of places in the Bible where it talks about abuse and abandonment, and that God is there for us. And so it was really through God's word and by having to just put my trust and faith back in him and realize that, you know, I had tried life both ways. I've tried it with and without. And, you know, without God, life always falls apart. And with God, somehow we're able to hang on, and he's with us, and we work through these situations. And in the book, I share a lot about that, because the family situations, especially church families, when we're told that we just need to forgive and then everything will be all better, you know, we do need to come to a point of forgiveness eventually. But unfortunately, you know, our families, when we do forgive, all these situations don't stop, and our family doesn't disappear. So we still have to have the tools to be able to safely deal with our families, protect our children, go through that forgiveness process. You know, forgiveness never means letting that person hurt another child.
Well, there's something completely different, and I'm reading a book right now, Forgiving the Unforgivable by Dr. David Stoop, and he says forgiveness and reconciliation are two different things.
Absolutely.
And I love this book, and when I read that, I thought, aha. That's exactly the point, is that we really tell people, for complete healing, you know, when we're working with families, for complete healing, you need to forgive, but forgiveness means you're releasing that person for them to work it out with their creator God. That is between them. And that doesn't mean you have to have Thanksgiving dinners with that person.
Exactly.
It's not always healthy to reconcile.
No, and a lot of times, I would say more often than not, especially if you're dealing with a pedophile, there can be no reconciliation because these people just are not capable of stopping. And it's very important, and that was one thing I did learn when I was going through the counseling in the early years. I did a lot of research on people who abuse children, and people that have a sexual attraction to children that are pedophiles, that abuse children in that way, they continue doing that, and they can victimize hundreds of children in their lifetime before they're ever caught.
Right. There's a statistic that says they have well over 300 victims in their lifetime.
Yes.
And that boggles most people's mind, like, how do we have access to 300 kids? They're that good.
Oh, yes, they are.
They are amazing, and usually, not always, to the public, they're extremely kind. My perpetrator, was also an elder in church. He was not related to me in any way, but we called him uncle. And they use that position of authority to gain access because people believe that they are amazing and how they're pouring into these families' lives, and they miss that they have insidious intentions to entrap the children in their families.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that, you know, for me, and I met with a woman once, and she says, I have forgiven my father. You know, my kids need to know their grandfather, but I watch him like a hawk because I don't want anything to happen to them, but it's my mom. I can't stand my mom because she allowed it. And in my heart, I'm like, okay, have I not forgiven my perpetrator? Because I don't ever want to see him again. I do not want to be in his presence. So then have I not forgiven him? And I really grappled with it for probably a week. And it was sometime thereafter my daughter asked me, well, have I ever met him? And I said, no, and you never will, because I never want to give him the opportunity to even think about you the way he thought about me.
Right.
And not that I would allow him to do anything or miss that, but I don't even want him to have the opportunity to think those thoughts about my child.
Yeah, I felt the exact same way about my children. I did not want them to even be an inkling in his mind whatsoever. And so there's just been no contact whatsoever. And it just wasn't safe. And while we, you know, we think we can manage by watching them like a hawk, there are so many different ways that these very skilled people abuse children. And it can be by things they say to them, the way they look at them. It's not reasonable to think that you can control what's going to happen when you're around someone like that. And so if you have someone who is a known abuser and has not been held liable, has not been convicted, has not, or even if they have and they're out again, you just have to just really protect it. The children are the most important. And you're so right. I've worked with women as well, Martha, that they're so angry with their mother, yet they forgive the perpetrator, and then, you know, they're trying to keep this happy family together, and it's very difficult. And a lot of people really experience the inability to forgive the mother because, you know, we want our mothers to love us and to protect us and to care for us. And when that doesn't happen, it's devastating.
Has your mom ever disclosed that she knew?
Not fully. I mean, she has never admitted that she knew what was going on, yet she was gone all the time. And that was a huge part of this, was that even if I wasn't being abused, I was being abandoned by my mother. And we've had a lot of long talks about just, you know, her mothering and, you know, why she didn't want to be home. And, you know, a lot of it was that no one liked this man. He was horrible. And then, of course, when we moved into this really horrible house, she just didn't want anything to do with it. And so she just found every way to never be home. yet didn't think a thing about leaving me with him all the time. And so we have had a lot of discussion about that. But in my instance, you know, and especially with the forgiveness aspect, there has not been one person in this entire situation, my mother, my stepfather. I eventually did get to know my biological father very late in life before he passed away. But not one of these people have come to me and said, gee, we're so sorry that we didn't take care of you. We're sorry that any of this happened. And that was a lot of, for me, the grappling with the forgiveness is because a lot of us want the other person to say they're sorry and then we'll forgive them. But sometimes that just doesn't happen. And it's not going to happen in my lifetime. No one is ever going to say they're sorry, yet I need to forgive because I need to be set free. And as soon as I forgive, you know, when you don't forgive, somebody owes you a debt. You've got to forgive that because you're forever tied. As long as you think they owe you something, you're forever tied to them. If you can just let it go, forgive the debt, set them free, then you can heal. And you're no longer bound to this person by this unforgiveness.
I wholeheartedly agree. And that's what I told my perpetrator exactly when I confronted him. You know, I am no longer bound to you.
Right.
And it is the most amazing feeling to remove those shackles and be free because we cannot change them. I have a question for you in regards to you talked about how skilled pedophiles are. And just so we give a glimpse to our listeners, can you recall any times that he was so skilled in the way in which he was either molesting you or documenting you for child pornography that the average person would have missed, and that our listeners just need to know so they understand how skilled and they are in hiding what they are doing and what parents need to be awakened to so they better protect their children?
Well, in this instance, the whole situation was just unusual. You know, the age difference between my mom and stepfather, his, especially being in the church, his rigid rules, being overly strict, the controlling of the family, just the inability for me to be a child. I was never allowed to go play with other kids. I was never allowed to participate in normal things that kids would participate in. He was so controlling that, for instance, you know, like I said, it was from the age of 5 until the age of 14, and being a young girl in church, you know, I did love God, and I remember accepting Jesus when I was 5 years old, right before they got married. It was about 3 weeks before the wedding actually took place, and I wanted to take communion, and I wanted to get baptized, but he would not allow it. He would not allow me to take communion. He wouldn't allow me to get baptized. It was just very strange the way he controlled our whole family. And so it's interesting, Martha, because you can just almost tell by the look on a child's face. When years later I was presenting at a conference, and somebody that had grown up in that church with us was at the conference, and I was talking about dealing with children that have been abused in school. And she came to my seminar, and at part of this whole seminar that I was doing, I would tell my own story. And when I was done, she came up to me and she was so upset. She was one of my mom's friends. And she said, I had no idea that this happened to you. And she was just devastated. So this conference was over a period of a couple days. And she came back the next day and she was crying again. And she said, I went home. And she goes, I pulled out all our old church directories. And she said, I looked at the pictures, because back in those days, in the church directories had a picture of the family and your name and address and phone number. And she said, I pulled them all out. I'd saved them. And she looked at them, and she said, I went through the pictures, and she said, I looked at you, and she said, clearly there was something wrong.
And that's, I laugh because I can picture the black and white directory of me at 7. And just turn the pages a few more, and you'll find my perpetrator and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually use pictures a lot. Right now, we're working with them with our women, And we can pinpoint when the abuse started because of the pictures.
Yeah. As soon as that happened, I called my mom and I asked her to send every picture she had of me. There weren't a lot of pictures of me, oddly enough.
And strangely, it's not odd. Most of our women do not have pictures. One woman has none. None.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I had my mom send every picture that she did have before and after the wedding, and she sent them, and I lined them up on the table, and clearly you can see the bright, beautiful, happy little child in the pictures before, and then just weeks later, the little girl who is now just sad, and the eyes are empty. Even the clothing, you know, we were made to wear hand-me-down clothes, and we lived, even though we had plenty of money, we lived as though we were in extreme poverty. And so I went from being this vivacious little girl to just a little destroyed child, and it was very evident.
What would you tell women and men who are listening right now and maybe going to their scrapbooks and pulling out pictures of themselves? And they see that distinction where they were a happy, bright-eyed child, and then they see the vacancy start to appear. What should they do after they discover that?
Well, Martha, are you referring to somebody who maybe has not been through any counseling or just coming to terms with abuse?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, definitely, the best thing that I ever did was to go talk to someone and reach out. And the whole counseling process, while it was painful, it was completely worth it because we were able to talk about the little girl before and the little girl after. And I really dealt for a long time, even through the healing process of being angry with the little girl after, because she didn't speak up. She didn't say anything. She took all this abuse. She didn't do anything about it. And I remember being very angry with her and having to realize that this is not unusual. And people will still ask me to this day, well, why didn't you tell? But children, especially young children, they don't have the words to verbalize this. They don't know. They don't understand. Who are you going to tell? You just don't have the language to be able to explain it. And then as time goes on, you don't want anybody to know this is happening to you. It's humiliating, it's embarrassing, it's scary. And on top of that, you've got the threats from the perpetrator about what's going to happen to you if you do tell. And so there are a lot of different emotions that go with thinking about the child before and the child after. And it really, really takes a skilled professional to help walk you through that. It's very, very important because, you know, the feelings and the emotions are intense, and you've got to have someone who has the knowledge to be able to walk you through those times.
And that's what we've told our listeners before, is you may tell someone, and if you don't get the response you're looking for, it's not on you. Not everybody's going to understand what it's like to be sexually abused, and it's not something you get over.
No, and it's very, very important to think about who you're going to tell. That decision needs to be well thought out. Hopefully, in the best of circumstances, it would be a professional, somebody who deals in sexual abuse. If you just want to go tell your best friend or, you know, your Bible study leader at church or whatever group you may be involved in, you may not get a good response because people don't understand it and they don't know how to react to it. A lot of the training that I did early on when I had my ministry with speaking on this, we helped even church leaders understand how to react when someone tells you what has happened to them, because a lot of people react with a look of shock, or, you know, some will react with a look of disgust, and of course the victim thinks that that person is disgusted with them, and they're not. They're disgusted with what this person has done to them. But just even the facial response when somebody tells can have a huge effect. So you want to be very careful to tell somebody who you have researched and that you know does understand.
And if you need help finding a person who is equipped to help you, There are a few ways in which we can help you. One, in many areas, dialing 211 will give you the resources in your area. Also, you can contact us at A Quarter Blue. You can email us with your information, with your location. You can be anywhere, and we will do our best to find a professional who is equipped to help you work through your sexual abuse. Maybe it's your sexual abuse, or maybe your child was sexually abused. Maybe your mom was sexually abused. It affects the whole family. And you all need help, and we want to help get you that help. And we'll, I mean, I've heard, we live in Kansas. There's nothing here. Well, give us the opportunity to try to help connect you with someone who is equipped and who wants to listen. That is why we are here. So please, once again, you can email us at info@aquarterblue.org. And Carol, if anyone has questions of you, is there a place where they can message you and get responses from you?
Yeah, they can contact me through my website, which is findinghopeministries.com.
And what have been some of your experiences in Finding Hope Ministries where people have started to experience this newfound freedom and hope?
Well, a lot of people, I mean, with going through this, with getting counseling, with getting help, people are experiencing just new life. You can go out and you can live life without fear, without substance abuse, without relationship problems. I mean, we're all going to have problems in life. Life is not going to be perfect. But once we face what's happened and once we begin that healing process, and, for me, of course, once I really understood that I have a God that will never leave me and never forsake me, that has been just the key to transformation, and it's been the key to transformation for so many other women and men that have gone through this, to know that God is there with us, He loves us, and despite the storms, despite the family difficulties, despite the ups and downs of life, He remains constant and He remains stable. And when we can reach up and grab His hand and hang on through everything, life becomes worth living.
I have some questions, just so people know. Where is your stepdad?
Well, my mother and stepfather stayed together through all of this. It's amazing. He will be, in December, he will be 100 years old. He is still alive. And they live on the East Coast, and there's just not a lot of contact.
With either your mom or your stepdad?
My mom and I talk occasionally on the phone, and about once every couple years she comes out to visit for about a week. But there's really not a lot of communication with the stepfather. He still tends to control the family, so if I decide to call my mom, he always is the one to answer the phone, so I have to go through him in order to talk to my mom. And so that's still a bit of a difficult situation. My situation with him was when I did forgive him, and we went through that process, and I talked to him, and I've talked to him on two different occasions about specifically, you know, what he did to me and the damage to the many, many other children that I know he has abused. He is not remorseful, and he was not sorry, and just really said that it was, you know, tough luck for me. And so it was, there's no opportunity for reconciliation at all, because there's absolutely no acknowledgement on his end that he caused any damage to anyone.
Do you know other victims that he abused outside of your brother, obviously?
Well, you know, when I left home and children were just coming in that house nonstop for years, and so at one point in my recovery, I knew that I could not allow that to happen. I was not going to turn a blind eye like my mom had. So when I had gone through counseling and we realized that my mom probably knew what was going on, that she wasn't going to stop it, and then we knew that there were still children in and out of that home, the neighborhood children, and lived in a very poor area. So he, like you said, they set themselves up as very kind, loving people. So he did a lot of, feeding children meals and, you know, being a source of support and money and different things that the neighborhood children would need. And so I knew that that was something that I could not I didn't live with myself knowing that that was going on. So there was a point in time where I called the police and told them the situation, told them about the child pornography, everything that had gone on. And so they launched a huge investigation. And at that point, I just knew that it would all end, that he would be caught, he would be arrested, and children would be safe. I really felt that God was leading me to do this. It was a huge step. It was very scary. It was probably the scariest thing I've ever done in my life, but I knew I had to do it, and so I did. And there was an investigation, and unfortunately, they weren't able to find anybody who would testify against him or admit that anything was going on. And so at the outcome of the investigation, the police came to me and said that they knew by them questioning him and the answers that he gave them about everything they were talking to him about, that he was a pedophile, but that there was nothing they could do except for keep an eye on him. And at that point, I was pretty disappointed again with God, because I had this whole plan. I knew if I turned him in, it would all end. He would be held accountable. The truth would finally come out. And I was just hugely disappointed. I can't even tell you how disappointed I was. And not only was it disappointment for me, of course, now it was exposed that I was the one that turned him in. And again, you know, I was the family bad guy. And so it was a very difficult situation, and one that it needed to be done, because I knew that for me, I had to do everything within my power to protect the children around him.
Well, I appreciate you doing that, and I'm sorry that they were unable to do anything. And unfortunately, that does happen. How did you come to a point where you were able to release that and know that you did as much as you could?
Well, you know, it went on. There were other things that still had to be done. You know, at this point in time, they were still living in Northeast LA, and when they made the decision to move to another part of the country, they were moving. He had children, biological children, from his first wife, and they were moving back to that area where there would be grandchildren and children in that area as well. And so it just didn't end there. I was relentless. I picked up the phone, called my stepbrother, and, you know, told him the whole story and let him know that, you know, they're coming out there, they're going to be living near you, you've got children, grandchildren, you cannot let them be near him, and you cannot think that if my mom is there, they'll be safe, because they won't be. And so, again, I'm the family bad guy, but I could not live with the fact that he was going to go back there and be near those children and not do my part. And so, you know, I've done everything in my power that I know of to be able to protect the children that I know of. And that was a huge part of my healing process as well, to know that I've done everything I can. I've totally committed my life to God, and I have just really found a way to balance my life through making sure that if I need counseling, I get counseling, making sure that I'm eating healthy and exercising, making sure that I'm staying connected with God. And then finally, the fourth piece is reaching out and helping others. And we find that if you can maintain that balance in your life, and if things get out of kilter, of course, for everyone every now and then, but striving for those four areas can really, really give you balance in your life and help you to move forward.
I want to know what you would tell various groups of people, and just two per group I give you. So if you're a mom and you're speaking to moms right now, what are the two things they need to know?
And who are we?
This is for moms raising children. What are the two things they need to know to help protect their kids, maybe to recognize signs? What do they need to know?
Well, first of all, an open relationship with your child. Your child needs to be able to tell you anything. And I think that is, you know, one of the reasons children don't tell is because they don't have that relationship with their mom where they feel that they can tell her anything. Kids often think they're going to get in trouble. They're told they're going to get in trouble. And so just making sure that, and I don't mean drilling your child every day, whether, you know, you don't want to be scaring your children, but you need to have that open relationship that they know that they can come to you with just absolutely anything. With my daughter, the whole time she was growing up, she knew that she could come to me with any problem, no matter how severe. When she was young, she knew that. Even in her teen years, she knew that no matter what happened, that she could come to me. And as an adult, she's in college now, she confides everything in me, and it's just a wonderful relationship because we love and respect each other, and she knows that beyond a shadow of a doubt, no matter what happens, that she can come and tell me anything. And so I would say just really working on the relationship. As far as signs of abuse, just knowing who your children are around and knowing who you're around. A lot of single women may get involved with men that may not be have the best of intentions, and so it's really important to be very knowing of who your friends and contacts and relatives are. If you have relatives that, you know, when you have that gut feeling that something's wrong, something probably is wrong.
Absolutely. What about for church leaders or teachers? Because obviously, now looking back on it, there were signs with you. So what would you tell people who are working with children, whether it be in church or in schools?
Well, absolutely, looking at changes in behavior, whether a child is sad. You know, I was a very sad and sullen child, and I was afraid of everything. And so just looking at kids that, you know, may be definite behavior changes. If you see a normally happy kid suddenly be very, very sad or withdrawn, you know, those are things that you can look for. In churches and schools, you know, when this was going on with me, we didn't have the mandated reporting laws that we have now, and so people are much better educated on how to report and how to spot different things, but it can be just very difficult to detect. And so just watching again, you know, a child's behavior, looking for those signs of changes and being able to hopefully talk to that child if they appear to be needing assistance.
And the way that you do that is you ask questions that aren't leading. You
exactly.
Just ask open-ended questions. And if there you do suspect abuse, you need to immediately contact the authorities so that the professionals are doing their job.
Right.
Now, once again, will you please share what your website is, how people can get your book, and what are other aspects of your work so they can get involved?
Well, the website is findinghopeministries.com, and the book can be purchased directly through the website. It's also on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, so you can look it up there. The name of the book is Where is God When Hope Hurts? And you can just search my name, Carol Urton. It's U-R-T-O-N. And in my work, you know, I do speaking. If anybody needs a speaker for an event, I can come out, talk to your group. My work, I actually work at the Orange County Rescue Mission working with homeless families in transition. So we do a lot of work through there. There's always volunteer opportunities through the Orange County Rescue Mission as well.
That's awesome. I appreciate all you've shared. And I know there's so much more you have to share. And so people, you need to definitely purchase her book and gain more insights of how to work through the hurt so you can experience true hope and healing. Carol, I appreciate you. Just like I said, I appreciate your honesty and your vulnerability and your willingness to now reach out and help others. And if you want to experience more of A Quarter Blues Works, there's a lot of ways. We just had an amazing art exhibit at Whittier Art Gallery, and I appreciate that they open up their doors to our show called Behind Closed Doors. They had an amazing reception last night where it brought together the families that are in our community whose families have been affected by sexual abuse, and they were surrounded by the community of Whittier. And we're just around the corner from Child Abuse Prevention Month, which is April. So I encourage you to get your blue on. Blue is the ribbon for child abuse prevention, whether it be painting your nails blue, wearing blue shoelaces. I actually dyed a quarter of my hair blue this week to represent. Or you could come out to one of our activities, our art exhibits. April 8th through 12th, we will be at the Women's Club. April 1st through May 9th, the city of Whittier in City Hall is having up our artworks, and they're going to have our installation art of our doors on April 23rd. Carol, would you have any last words for our listeners before we say goodbye and thank you?
I just want to encourage anybody that is out there that has struggled with any of these areas that there is hope, and to please reach out, find someone you can talk to, and begin taking the steps to recovery, because it is possible. There is such hope in God and hope in just life, that you can live life free of all these hurts, but it does take a step of action on your part. So I would just encourage you to do that.
Thank you so much. You can reach out to us at aquarterblue.org. If you want to support our work, that would be greatly appreciated. You can make a donation there at aquarterblue.org. Live well, experience hope, and watch beauty rise out of the ashes, because there's beauty within you just waiting to burst forth. Thank you and good night.